Film is such a unique medium because it's inherently self-reflexive. It has the ability to think about itself, its own technology, how it's made, how it produces it, and it of course makes us think about how we perceive it and how we relate to it, and then how we relate to the world. Ziga Vertov was one of these amazing filmmakers who was a part of the movement who wanted to change the world with the revolutionary ideas, and he felt that kino eye is offers us a new way to perceive the world, to perceive it anew, and just turn it upside down. And this is why I really enjoyed watching everything that was made here, because it completely, not completely, but significantly enough, allows us to consider that reality is not flat, straight, with a clear perspective, but it can be turned. It can be turned upside down. We don't need to follow things exactly the way we see them. There are different ways and different potentialities of getting at things, getting at the world, getting at how it is, how it works. And I feel like once we start getting at the world from a different point of view, we have to kind of reconfigure everything else that we previously as well. And if we're so comfortably, you know, kind of nesting in this habitual conventional perceptions that we learn, you know, culturally or however else. So, I really love
I just came to apologize for my name. It's a really bad film. It's really old one. Like, I really didn't. I wrote a very long email to the guy saying, please don't show it.
That's true.
It's terrible, shocking work. It should never be shown. No, but it's a strange, it's an older thing. But it's done, I think, in like a lot of, not in a fairly naive way. But I never really saw any quality to it until like sort of years later. And the quality is always something that's like not, it's anti-quality that I like.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, no, I agree with everything you're saying. I think films should aspire to this shifting of perspective. It's, I think it's almost impossible to do correctly, but to do right, but it's like something that like it seems to be the goal. And I don't know.
I don't know.
Should we use the microphones for?
I don't know. The microphone. I want to say that I think you succeeded because you made something personal, and that's my goal, is to make something personal. I'm not really trying to blow anybody's mind, but I think that I learned a lot about you with your film, whether it's past or present. And congratulations.
Oh.
What makes you squirm when you see it? What is it precisely that you're so unhappy with?
I think it was because like I come from such quite a classical background, drawing and painting and stuff, and then when this was really made for no particular audience. And my name isn't in the credits, for example, like I didn't put it as a thing. And then it was only like until, it's not, I think 4 years after I began it that someone submitted it to a festival on my behalf. And then I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I've never been to a film festival before and all that. So then I kind of my perspective on it shifted a little bit more, where I was like, okay with it being shown, but I think it's because it's so, I think it's just like, I was starting a thing and then not knowing how to finish it, so from when I look at it now, I see a lot of space in there, there's nothing happening or nothing much going on, where there could be more interesting or funny or profound or any kind of material, or just basically more meat to it, you know, like for my taste. I don't have a problem with the style of it at all, but I think writing wise, it sort of makes me like, oh, I don't know what I was doing.
But
it's like every time, it's a non-stop thing you have. It's like, if I think about discussions I had 6 months ago, I think, God, I was such a fucking idiot. Like, I had no idea what I was talking about 6 months ago. It's because you're always learning and stuff, you know what I mean? But that's like, I guess because it's the oldest one, it's like the one that makes me most, kind of uncomfortable or whatever.
I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah.
I don't want to look at anything that I did that's a year or two old or more.
Yeah.
So.
I feel so immature, and whenever I see something that I've written like a while ago, I'm just like, oh my god, this hurts. And honestly, I'm just not interested in it anymore. It's just like I've digested it. No, and I think that this is something that would be interesting to talk about.
I don't know. It's really funny because we live in this world that we're just fed all this information, and you know, we're fed what knowledge is and what creativity is, and so on. But I don't think it's that. Transparent or that like easy to pin down.
Yeah.
I think creativity. There's this French philosopher Gilles Deleuze. Maybe you've heard about him. But he said once, you know, in his French accent, well, creativity that doesn't just happen every day. When it does, it's an event. It's a celebration. It's a rare thing. But it requires, what I found about creativity or a creative impulse or a new idea, let's say, it really requires so much commitment. And I mean, it's so cool now that we're all talking together and you know, we can discuss and feed off of one another and each other's ideas and energies. But then you have to kind of like, sit by yourself, and it's very solitary work, at least what I do, like, because I write. But it's such a solitary work, and you get rewarded by these moments of ecstasy when you finally get to articulate what you've sensed, seen, and then kind of started to be able to think and even like spit out. So I don't know, creative process is something that, you know, or creativity, I would be just curious to, you know, hear what you guys also think, feel, or how you do it, or...
Can I add on to that question?
Yeah.
Because I
Would you like the mic?
No, it's okay. it's all the films that were shown tonight were created under such different circumstances, you know. A true film set, a computer, Pasadena Freeway still is just kind of like one room, and then John Smith is just taking one straight shot pretty much with a couple of other shots in there. Georgetown Loop came originally from like a paper negative in the what's it called, the big library in Washington, D.C., the National Archives. And so I wondered, I mean, maybe this is a question you could start off answering, Mark, because you've come across so many avant-garde experimental filmmakers. What, like, talking about creativity, like, how many times have you seen these experimental films really planned out, or are they truly experimental, especially with really perceptually bending stuff? Is it something that takes a lot of planning, or can you just sort of go into a room and...
Actually, what I'd rather say, if you don't mind, is thinking one thing that a lot of these works, all the work I thought had in common was a certain very distilled, sort of stripped down space in which they were working. I mean, even though David's piece has also a certain maybe maximalist quality visually, it's actually in a way a quite restrictively defined universe, I think. And I think all of them kind of work with this sort of minimal formal quality that maybe is something they have in common in terms of connecting to our subjective perception and playing with our perception, because perhaps there's something to be said for a sort of a stripped down, reduced, minimal quality, which can maybe heighten our perception of what we're looking at. Like with Diaz's film, I was like, well, I feel like I'm maybe missing something right from the beginning. I'm like, what's, there's something mysterious about what's going on, but I'm not sure what, and I'm like kind of, and I found myself in a very heightened state actually watching it. And so even little things, I was like, wait, did that mean something very significant that I wasn't quite sure I picked up on or not? And I actually really love that. And like with David's piece, I love that the constantly shifting perspective, whereas actually the world itself, if I'm not mistaken, it actually maintains a consistent sort of form, but it's entirely our XYZ relationship to the axes that's changing. It's like impossible to actually kind of hone in on a visual understanding of what's happening. And I mean, and I was very aware of how much a visual apprehension really cues how we understand narrative, even, and just the dialogue and how that was being transformed just by not being able to get a handle on things spatially. And same with Gary's film, this kind of transition between still and moving, and even showing us kind of how movies work in the process. And John's film, which I love, where you gradually realize, yeah, this has to not be related, this sound of image, right? And then Ken's, again, a classic, where this very simple film, which was a document of this train route, I mean, just by putting it next to itself in a mirrored configuration, it utterly transforms how we perceive it. It's like this really reduced, kind of simple means in a way with which the audience is meant to experience things in a totally transformed way. So for me, the commonality in a way was a certain kind of reduction of the information given you.
That's really true, yeah.
You know, I really love your film.
Thank you.
I really, really enjoyed it. I and you know, especially what Mark said, it's really, really very subtle, and it really sensitizes you to a very specific way of, you know, perceiving this space. And it's almost like as if that space or that room had a personality of its own. It was kind of like a character there together with the, you know, woman. I really enjoyed, because it wasn't horror type of a thing at all, but I enjoyed this developing and breathing presence of something that we usually define as an object or not alive, but it felt very alive. And, you know, I just wonder how did you develop this idea? How did it come to you?
Well, it's a film that I made trying to break free, and then it turned into this. But basically, the idea started with, we come in and out of our houses, and sometimes the closest thing to us is our living room. But I was trying to talk about change and the difficulty and the struggle. You know, we get stuck in these cycles and repeating the same things over and over. So I like the idea of, even though there's a window, Lydia never thinks to go out the window, because I guess I see myself in her. But as I made the film and I started editing it, I feel like the film has sort of taken a life of its own. And I did work very hard on the environment, because I rented it from a friend, and it was something completely different that we painted and made into. It was blue and brown, and I made it into this. And I do like that as we see the space that Lydia lives in, it sort of takes a rhythm when she's there. It becomes more alive, and slowly it becomes more alive. I don't know, did that answer your question?
Yeah, it wasn't even in a question. It was just cute. Because I was just curious about the film. The one thing that I noticed this time that I didn't pay so much attention to is the carpet. That carpet kind of like really, you know, that she would have been laying outside on the sand. At first I didn't connect that carpet to her first initially falling asleep. She spent a lot of, that carpet was kind of like visually almost in the center there.
I wrote it thinking about the carpet, thinking that the carpet would,
yeah.
I mean, everything that was there, I put it there on purpose.
Yeah. It felt very purposefully, but not purposefully in a very, you know, restrictive way. So, thank you.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know from your concept to the execution. You know, sitting here tonight watching the film, how close or far apart those things are.
You know, I didn't really watch it that much. I watched it, but I wasn't that focused on it. But I think that your question is, if when I began, is this what I pictured?
Does it deliver on what you were hoping?
Absolutely.
That,
and it surprises me because I feel like after showing it to a few people, people mentioned that it was disturbing and kind of spooky. Some people, other people didn't think that, and that was a surprise to me because I didn't do it intentionally. Yeah, so I kind of feel like the room took a life of its own.
People with existential fear is terrifying.
Well, I think when you write something about somebody being stuck, and for me it was more symbolic, you know, the idea of being stuck and the struggle of change, but once you see it, it becomes so literal.
I have a question. I mean, is there a reason why the day is kind of like a blank slate, but your room's empty, your style is kind of like not that interesting? Like, what is it about her that we're supposed to like relate to? Is she meant to be like a blank slate, as someone that anybody could put their self on, or like is Lydia someone like very specific?
You know, when I was writing the story, I thought about those things. Should I give her more of a character? Maybe she's a performer, you know, and I talked to the actress while I was writing the story, but as I kept going, I realized that that's not what was important to me, her story in regards to what she does or where she was going. What was important is that she wasn't going anywhere. And I really like her style. But I can see what the colors that I chose, and they all have this sort of a paleness to them. It's true.
Yeah, it was like really ghostly. I thought it was scary too. Like, it really did scare me. It was like watching her go through that whole thing, I was like, okay, no, I'm not like that. Like, the whole time I was kind of thinking, like, I don't want to, even if I do relate to Lydia, I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that for most people, it's hard to get ourselves unstuck from what we do every day. So maybe you could relate in that way.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting because, you know, all of this space that she's in kind of does take a life on its own. But at the same time, like, I experienced it a little bit as also like exteriorization of her kind of inability to move, you know. So it was maybe that really some kind of discomfort that she felt within herself. It's almost as if space was like a mirror for her psyche or something like that. If that was worse, or a part of her psyche.
Also, I was trying to talk about not giving up, and I think that she didn't, and she fell because she was so tired. But in the end, she sort of dreams herself out of the room because she never stopped.
Yeah.
Her desire to, I guess, feel connected to something else.
Yeah. You were talking about the creative process at first, and this could be part of the way was kind of related to her, but I think somehow that kind of weird, solitary stuffness and that circularity and that kind of insanity of being with an idea until you either dream yourself out of it or stumble out of it or something resolves. I think that just it's a funny coincidence that feeling from that film reminds me of the process of working and being with your work. In a way, like the room is like your work. And you're like, what is the little man that I'm in? And you know, that it's a really weird relationship.
But when you bring that as a ritual begins, you know, because we all have these ideas of like, you know, my friends tell myself, like, I wake up in the morning and I prepare a cup of coffee. Wait, it's just like it's ritualistic for me. I go through the same process in the morning. I actually want an enjoyment. And it's not that I feel stuck in it because like, I need it and I have, but, and you know, like just the simple fact of like, you know, in my holiday time, where like you do these simple things that are like ritualistic or tradition for people. So where, like in our perception, where does that change? And where does that fit in? Or do you think it does?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I just feel like everyone's talking about this idea that it was like anxious and like the creative process was like, you know, here this is like for instance the video is, you know, stuck in space.
Mm-hmm.
But for me it was almost comforting because it was like she had these rituals that she was performing in the space and it wasn't as though it was stuck.
Well, that's a good point, because when I wrote the story, I didn't see her stuck the whole time. I was thinking, you know, she's leaving and the camera never leaves, but she leaves. We hear it with the sound, you know, I put steps. And I felt that she becomes stuck later. But yeah, she's eating a sandwich, you know, she's enjoying it. She goes somewhere, she takes her suitcase. So yeah, I think she's enjoying it at the beginning.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, that themes are so related, actually, in your movies, because you are also like, I felt like the highlight of your thing was when that little he manages to get away from, he defeats the bad guy. I mean, not the bad guy, the guy who is telling him to be like everyone else, basically. And then there was one sentence that, which I forgot, unfortunately. I should have written down, but basically, he manages to be himself.
It is hilarious. Kind of use like the tropes of like this almost like kind of Disney-esque hero story. It's totally fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're actually right. I didn't even think about it, but it's true. It's like a bunch of stuff in there about like routine and, you know, boredom. Boredom being the sort of enemy of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true. It's like a really fundamental thing. Very hard, I think, to get right in really expressing that. And certainly, like
when you're in that, but when it is like, it's a very familiar emotion to anybody who does anything creative, I think, you know, it's like, I mean, it's like you said earlier, I think it is like, it is such, there's an enormous amount of, I don't know, concentration necessary to kind of make anything.
Mm-hmm.
But in between that concentration, it's just like, this is like wasteland of, you know, what the fuck do I do?
Exactly.
And so it does, it's a familiar sort of thing.
Oh, but you know, earlier when you mentioned that, you know, now that you see it again, you see what you could have done better and different and more and so on.
Yeah.
But you've seen this a million times. But for those of us who has not seen it a million times, but let's say 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 times, it works.
Uh-huh.
It's saturated enough because it does demand quite a bit of. I feel like the way we relate to film is not, we're not just watching, we're not just taking it in, we're kind of engaged with it very physically, not just like with visual perception.
Not just passive, yeah.
It's very sensory, yeah.
That the maker can't ever look at the piece like the audience can, no matter how many times either of them see it. I mean, there's just a simple disconnect between those two viewers. So like,
I can only
think about having made it and maybe the choices he would make differently, but we're not going to think. I mean, if
yeah, I'm the worst person to ever ask about it.
Yeah.
You know.
And if any of us, even after watching it however many times, decided, oh, you know, maybe it would have been better if he had done this, I mean, it wouldn't probably at all be the same thing that he was unhappy with.
No, but I felt it was just so rich, like on all levels, because it really, it really requires us to kind of like shift also, you know, how we would, I mean, of course, well, you always relate to the character and the story and the narrative, but then, you know, with turning things upside down and so on, I think it required some additional effort. You know, the XYZ axis, they really did kind of ask us to work.
It kind of punishes you, it rewards you for watching it with punishment.
It kind of does.
So like basically there's like three cameras, there's a setup I think with like three cameras, and so when I was like rendering the scene, it would kind of automatically switch from perspective to orthographic, meaning like no perspective, to an upside down camera. It would just like switch around all the time, completely automatically. So certain things were tracked and stuff, so you get this complete, like, for me it was really just because I'd worked in classical animation studios where you learn about layout theory and you do everything, you know, anatomy and all these classical sort of subjects that have sort of like that have been a part of sort of learning animation for 50 years or whatever, and part of like art, part of like painting and stuff for hundreds of years. And then you realize that, like, oh, you can actually do crazy things with layout and go nuts with it, and you can still get something that is legible somehow, or that you follow, I think the cool thing about the computer is that you can actually generate things like this that I don't think could have happened on paper, and test, kind of like experiment with your perception, see like, oh, actually that'll work, like you'll be able to follow that even if it's as hard as like punishing as possible. Visually, it's still hopefully you can still sort of empathize or follow along as a simple narrative or something, you know.
I find it's particularly so with the 3D,
mm-hmm.
when you have that involved, like you really have to experiment and see how you know your body will go with it.
Yeah,
kind of. Because you are moving, you know, you are kind of almost imagining or kind of performing what is going on the screen. At least,
I think you do that with every film to an extent.
With every film,
yeah.
But with 3D, it's kind of even more.
You have to.
You have to
kind of actively project into it. I think sometimes because it's giving, because it looks terrifying and freaky. like by default. Mm-hmm. Like the basic, if anybody learning 3D will know this, that like everything looks terrible for a long time. And so, but there's something interesting about how terrible it is. And so like, yeah, it does involve like, it involves like a participation, like a lot of participation to just follow along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I thought was really great about your piece was that I remember seeing a public show recently about like this guy, the serial killer, and the subject matter was like very dark, right? And like if it was performed by people,
yeah,
it would hurt to watch. And
yeah,
I felt like yours was this same kind of like painful subject matter, but it's easily digestible because we're looking at these like silly characters.
Uh huh.
And like, I mean, it's really depressing what he goes through. And what's great is that he's triumphant. It's like a heroic story. But instead of feeling, we're able to like sit through it and enjoy it instead of being like, man.
Like just bummed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually a really nice thing to say. It's nice when something can work in that way, right? Mm-hmm. You can get like, I think that's a thing that I try and explore with other things as well, is that like just seeing what you can kind of get away with animation, because there's so much that's not, there's so many ideas that aren't, they're completely not for children that animation is actually really good for. And you see it with comics a bunch, but animation is like, you don't see it a whole lot, but it is like, it is fun to explore these things.
What I really liked about your film was the clash of it. You know, it's a robot world, but in some ways, it was the most human film, the most grounded in a reality. And I really cared for the character because I could relate.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Yeah. It's cool to feel emotion for like a robot voice. Oh, right, uh-huh.
I was very, especially the sound design and the... Oh, and the virtualing and the going back and forth, the feeling stuck.
Uh-huh.
I think it was actually...
Yeah, there was some, like, nested doors in there, I think, in one scene and stuff that's similar. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So, again, I think the reduction of setting helps maybe heighten the potential for emotional response.
I'd say, yeah, the reduction of everything. It's like, I totally agree with what you said about that. Like, and I think, yeah, like the simpler, as everything breaks down, you have so much more space for your brain to like go into corner, you know.
I'm a big fan of the non-definitive.
Uh-huh.
That's like, your piece is just all about not being definitive about anything, and which is a really powerful quality that it has, I think. There's a lot of open, responsive and emotional space to fill for the viewer. And I mean, obviously a few people have even kind of disagreed in a sense about what the mood that they felt from it, which I think is a really strong aspect of it. And actually, yeah, David, I've seen a few of your other pieces in the past, and there's always this, in a sense, a very simple, almost universal, maybe conflict or a set of characters with particular qualities that are really relatable in a fairly universal way, but then the details of how they're articulated are so twisted. And yet, in a way, that twist is kind of what makes them more, even more relatable, because if they were typical, they'd be trite, maybe. But in this bizarre, perverted universe, in a sense, and with the dialogue being odd and off and wrong in a way, it somehow makes it more powerful, and it actually kind of pokes at you a little bit emotionally, more sharply.
Yeah, thank you. I would say that, I would be a terrible live action filmmaker. I'm very comfortable in the animation
space. Live action
space.
Actors saying these lines.
Yeah. No, like, but I know, I kind of know what you're saying. Like, I think you can be sort of bold with certain, like, I can feel more, like, bold with ideas when I think about and think in the animation space, and some of them are even like are corny and crap and stuff, but I know that they'll work in the context, in the general context of a certain project. And but yeah it would suck in live action. My mom's always asking me, when are you going to make a real film? Yeah, I'll stop messing around with these joke cartoons. I'm curious, Diaz, as well, like, you put one line of dialogue in there, which is, like, I think just can't help but draw attention to itself, because it's, like, the one line you chose to say. But how long did, like, did you really, because, and it's quite a poetic line as well, I think. Is it something that you struggled with for a while? Did you try different lines, or?
I stole the line.
Really?
I stole the line from, I think because I'm on stage, I can't remember the name of the film. Betty Davis. What's that black and white film? I stole the line.
But it was just that one line, you knew it was going to be that one, and then, did you shoot any other ones?
No, I couldn't come up with anything better. It seemed like her longing to be connected, and at the same time, it takes you out of the film. I like that it reminds the audience we're watching a film. You know, it speaks to the audience. And I also like that it's a really lonely thing, you know, to look at yourself and talk about the heart of an artichoke.
Yeah, but also even just to speak to to talk to yourself, it's kind of like, I actually thought that there was somebody dead for a while or something, and she was talking to them or whatever. Or yeah, I couldn't. Yeah, it was very mysterious.
My first thought was to equate the film to an artichoke.
Structurally,
right? Oh, is it all about Eve? Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I started thinking about it when you're kind of unwrapping an artichoke, and I was maybe just the immediate reaction.
Also, it's kind of a joke, you know, the heart of an artichoke. That was kind of cool too. But what I liked it too is this. I love films, you know, I love narrative films as well, and I'm very influenced by them every day, and that's another reason why I put it in there.
So it's kind of an epiphany moment for a viewer too, in the way that I think also John Smith's movie and Gary's movie have in common, particularly of just speaking to the things we saw tonight. Because for me, in John's film, when you first kind of realize, oh, wait a minute, is this bullshit? And then with Gary's, when you first realize, oh, wait, he's not showing the same photo over and over, it's actually sequential frames of the in a funny way, I had the same kind of reaction when she spoke. It really, like, oh my gosh, like, it's really this, like, intrusive but exciting moment that had a weird emotional heft to it that I actually also feel with those other two films, although it's a different emotion in a way, too. It's almost like being caught peeking or something. Like, I felt like, oh shit, it's like, there was a funny feeling of, like, she caught us looking.
That's great, because I wanted to create an intimate, I wanted it to be an intimate space of somebody by themselves, and I wonder what Charlie Chaplin would have said if he had sound when he made those silent films, what his one line would have been.
I'm so glad you brought up the language, because I thought it was so important, and actually, the movie that you brought, the Pasadena Freeway, I really, really loved that. And it was almost like an elaboration, contemporary elaboration of Chris Marker's La Jetée, where there's, you know, a whole film of photographs, and then there's just one moment when a woman blinks. And it's also like very kind of reflexive of the medium, you know, and the difference between photography and what film brings in, like the movement, you know, and how that, you know, makes a whole different experience and makes us feel differently and just relate to the material differently.
I think it's funny, you mentioned La Jetée, because actually that seems to me to relate very much to the moment in Diaz's film. Again, it feels like an intimacy confirmed or an intimacy acknowledged. That happens, sorry for anybody who hasn't seen La Jetée, but it's pretty easy to see, and I highly recommend it. But yeah, you're experiencing a very complex narrative, first person through all these, or no, it's not first person actually, through all these stills, and then there's a moment of great intimacy. intimacy where it becomes a moving image and the woman blinks. And you could, at first you're not even sure it's a moving image.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly powerful because it's heightened and by being this unexpected.
Yeah, moment. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you've been taught something in a way.
Yeah, you've been
which
yeah.
We also, again, I think experience with John's movie. I mean, and I think it actually brings up the idea that we inherently trust what we're seeing. Too. I mean, speaking again of perception, and so, like, there's nothing immediately mystical, say, about your film, but there's a suggestion later that on one hand it's a metaphorical routine, but it could also it's also this Twilight Zone-y kind of thing, like, oh, she really is kind of there's this weird like cosmic thing happening as well, but it's ambiguous, and so that's. Again, part of the
I think the room really works. I really wanted to find a room that had the two doors. So I'm really, really happy with that. One of them was a bathroom. And so we just blocked it out and then obviously I did it together. But I really like the two doors.
I think the difference, I mean, I think for me in terms of the difference between the Pasadena film and the first one, which is called
Girl Chewing Gum.
You know, is that they're coming from such a place of exuberance. I mean, like, so, you know, the idea of this film, I think with your film, there's this process of creation. It's a struggle, it's a story of struggle. And yes, they're playing God in their own way with these two other films. We're seeing this process and he's making magic happen. We're seeing him take it before him and suddenly showing him, wow, look what we can do with this. And here we can break it down to frames and suddenly we have motion. And it's the same thing with the first one, which is, yeah, okay, the process of creation could be a struggle, but with just a really slight shift in perspective, even in a single long take, suddenly you're God, suddenly you're, everything is a playground, suddenly I'm conducting this whole thing, and it's coming from such a place of joy.
Well, and David was, in many ways, literally conducting what was going on, but am I understanding right that, to some degree, the changes of perspective were not planned by you, but just sort of set
it's like a semi-automated thing, yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's weird, because you know, when you're, I mean, also the same as a lot of the environments were the same, like I kind of like set up a system where I need some junk in the background, so I have like some scripts that will generate some crazy stuff, and then you play with that, and even though it's sort of random, you do, and with the editing and the cameras and stuff, you find yourself saying like, it makes more sense, this nonsense makes more sense this way, and this nonsense, makes, you know what I mean? So it's like, you can't, you still, it's weird, you still make editing decisions, but but yeah, it's like it's sort of like within these certain boundaries that you set up. Yeah, it's a little bit like, do you remember the boss of it all, Lars von Trier film, which had this cool system where like there was a sensor, like he didn't put a camera crew in one place, but like it's like a robot, and wherever the actors were, the camera would automatically cut to it. It was sort of like that one. It's like you just end up with a bunch of stuff, and then it's. You edit between them.
Well, I know, like John Smith said about The Girl Chewing Gum, that when he first shot it, it's an early film of his, and when he first shot it, there's the zoom on the clock, and then it zooms back, and when he got the footage back, he's like, oh man, it's totally jerky, and he wasn't happy, he wanted it to be a really smooth zoom, but then he said, well, wait a minute, I mean, the whole point of this film is that I'm directing reality, so he says on the narration, okay, I want the clock to move jerkily toward me. So he all gets to do is say it and it happens, like no matter what happens. And I mean, in a way, that's, I mean, he had to have his own epiphany about his own concept to realize its potential.
Yeah.
And that film for me, which what's strange about it is that I think it's really funny and it's a brilliant idea and so many people after copied him essentially. But it's also a weirdly poetic articulation of that very funny kind of crystalline idea, because he develops it and he actually does more things with it than in a way he has any business doing in the one film. It could just be a joke, and in fact, I was remembering that there's a late 70s Saturday Night Live episode where somebody essentially ripped off that concept and made like a 5-minute movie where somebody's directing reality. Exact same thing, but it's just a joke. And with John's film, somehow he's getting at some larger issues, which, like, and again, not to try to artificially relate these films because we saw them together, but in your piece too, the same thing. There's a lot of humor and there's a burlesque quality to a lot of it, but it still is, it has this poetry that sort of seeps through all that, and I think is all the more palpable, maybe because of the strange environment.
Yeah. Or it could all be a joke. All right. I actually have to run. I have to shoot off.
I think that's a good ending for me.